From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Monday, March 27th, 2017. And on this day, a bill in the legislature would make political contributions much less transparent, and a young Maine skier who's having a very good year. That's all ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
Maine law requires candidates and political action committees to quickly report major campaign contributions and expenditures during the 2 weeks before an election. A new proposal would scrap that requirement, so that information would not be available until weeks after Election Day. Steve Missler has our story.
Last year, candidates, PACs, and ballot question campaigns disclosed more than $2.6 million of spending under what's known as 24-hour reporting. This activity was available to members of the public before Election Day, allowing them to track major spending and contributions within 24 hours of each transaction. A proposal by Republican Senate Leader Garrett Mason, and backed by both Democrats and Republicans, would scrap the requirement. If enacted, the flurry of spending and contributions 2 weeks before an election would remain hidden until 42 days after Election Day.
As we all know, the final days of a general election are taxing on candidates. Things sometimes fall through the cracks.
During a public hearing on the bill Monday, Mason argued that the reporting requirement is burdensome and can ensnare inexperienced campaigns, subjecting them to fines. And Kate Knox agrees. Knox is general counsel for the Maine Democratic Party, but told the Veterans and Legal Affairs Committee that she had come to testify in her personal capacity. She said that 24-hour reporting is irrelevant because the state no longer allows publicly funded candidates to receive additional matching funds when their opponent outspends them.
Those matching funds don't exist anymore. I think the only policy left is really transparency. And that's a very important policy.
But transparency would suffer under the proposal, says Andrew Bossie with the Maine Citizens for Clean Elections. Bossie told lawmakers that the 24-hour disclosure comes at a critical time, 2 weeks before an election, when campaigns are most active, spending is at its peak, and voters are paying attention.
This is when large amounts of money can sway a race, and it's also when voters are making up their minds.
Bossie also took issue with the argument that timely disclosure is now irrelevant, because of changes to Maine's public campaign finance law. According to Jonathan Wayne, director of the Maine Ethics Commission, Maine has had a timely disclosure requirement since 1976. Maine is now one of 14 states that require timely disclosure, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. Still, Wayne says the Ethics Commission has supported cutting back on the 24-hour disclosure because a lot of spending is reported in so-called independent expenditure reports. Those are filed by campaigns who can spend unlimited amounts of money to influence an election. And spending by these groups has skyrocketed since 2010, hitting over $14 million 2 years ago. During that time, campaigns have become increasingly sophisticated, and coordination between multiple PACs has made it harder to follow the money trail. Under the new proposal, it still might be possible to quickly see which campaign is spending money to influence a race or ballot question. But the true origin of the money might not be known until well after the election. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
After a dismal and nearly snowless winter last year, New England ski resorts are winding up a much better season, and some of Maine's young athletes are having a pretty good run, too. Fred Bever has that story from the U.S. Championships at Sugarloaf.
The season got a monster start right out of the gate when Vermont's Killington Ski Resort attracted the region's first World Cup event in a quarter century.
Everybody's waiting for the game.
More than 10,000 spectators showed up, many of them to see Olympic and World Cup winner Michaela Schifrin race in the women's slalom. Schifrin's a graduate of Burke Mountain Academy in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom. As you can hear, she won. Now, near the end of a season that's seen some big snow, some big thaws, and then more snow, a handful of younger New England skiers are making some noise. 2 weeks ago, Alice Merriweather, a Hingham, Mass. Native who learned to ski at New Hampshire's Attitash Mountain, won the Junior World Downhill Championship in Åre, Sweden. It's the World Cup for skiers, 20 or under. On the men's side, Maine native Sam Morse, a Sugarloaf skier since before he was two and trained there by skiing legend Bodie Miller's former coach, took the downhill gold. This week, they are both racing in the U.S. Championships at Sugarloaf.
So the downhill is the fastest, kind of least controlled setting that we race.
Sitting in his father's furniture store, located on the mountain's downslope, Morse describes his favorite event.
It's high speeds, there's big jumps. It definitely takes, like, technical skiing ability and some courage.
A few minutes later, Alice Merriweather joins the conversation. She and Morse have known each other a decade, skiing in the regional, national, and now international circuits together. It's pretty remarkable, she says, that they're both winning the speed races.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, especially being from the East Coast. You don't see a lot of speed skiers out of the East, and so to have the two World Junior Downhill champions be from, you know, small mountains on the East is pretty cool.
Yeah, it was really exciting that day just because they race in the morning and we raced after them. So I got to kind of like watch Alice win and then like watch her on the podium and sing, you know, the national anthem and stuff. And it was like inspiring for me to like, all right, like it'd be really cool if we could do this. And then to come down to the lead was unbelievable.
At Sugarloaf Saturday, Merriweather disqualified when she skied off course in the Super G, a turnier race than the downhill. Morse fared better, taking an early lead in the men's Super G. At the finish line, he gamely took media questions about his style.
Pretty much all subconscious at this point, yeah. You don't have time to really think. You execute, like, tactically, but your skiing-wise, it's either there or it's not. This time of year, you gotta just be going with what you have, what your body knows.
As that interview was unfolding, another competitor was racing down the course to what would prove to be the winning time. It was Ryan Cochran Siegel, who learned to ski in Richmond, Vermont, from his mother, Barbara Ann Cochran, winner of Olympic skiing gold in 1972. This new generation of New England stars have two more days of national championship races in Maine. Look for them in Europe next year, and maybe back at Killington. U.S. ski officials say a deal's almost done to bring the World Cup back there next year. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Fred Bever in Carrabassett Valley, Maine.
You never know if or when love might strike. As Americans' life expectancies grow, there is more time and maybe more opportunities to find a romantic partner. In this final story in our series on aging in this life, Patty White visited a couple who waited nearly a lifetime to find love.
As far as Doris Maitland was concerned, she was happy to be on her own. She'd tried marriage once before, devoted nearly three decades to a man who she says spent more time away than at home. Then, one day, he left for good. So, love was not something Doris felt compelled to try again.
Yeah, I was down on it. I had more things on my mind. I figured, well, fine, that's over with. Now I can do the career thing, and I can make a life for me. So, and I was. It was, and I was perfectly happy, perfectly content.
After her divorce, Doris was the happiest she'd been in a long time. Two decades later, in 2000, came her 50th high school reunion in Skowhegan. But as someone who looks ahead and never back, she had no interest in going, no matter how many phone calls she got from her former classmates.
Finally, one of them said to me, well, you know, it's probably the last reunion we'll have and so forth. And she went into a whole spiel about it. And I said, all right, I'll buy a ticket. And I still had no interest in it, but it stopped everybody from calling me.
I just wanted to go. I just felt that I should go. Period.
Norm Blomquist had only been to one other Skowhegan High School reunion decades before. He wanted to see if his former classmate, Doris, was there. When she wasn't, he left.
I thought about her a lot of times.
Norm had been married, too, for about 30 years. But the marriage was unhappy. After the divorce, Norm didn't feel much better, except for when his mind wandered to Doris, the girl he used to meet at the water fountain after school as a teenager.
Even in high school, you know it, and sometimes you just don't do a thing about it.
After waiting 50 years, he figured it was worth a try. He drove to Maine all the way from his home in North Carolina. When he arrived, he stopped in Oakland, where Doris now lives, to make a long overdue phone call.
I went to the police station and asked for her number. And where could I call, you know? And they questioned me, what do you want to see her for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Never seen me, you know. So I got the number and I called her.
this phone rang and somebody said, this is Norm, Norman Blomquist. I said, oh? And I said, where are you, being polite? And he was down at the end of the road. He said, I thought I'd stop by. So what do you say? I said, sure, come on up. And I was thinking, how do I handle this one?
Doris remembered Norm and the water fountain. Once a year, when the Skowhegan High School newsletter arrived in the mail, she'd glance to see if his name was still listed. When Norm showed up at her door, he convinced her to go to the reunion. A few days later, he arrived at the venue early, found a table, and waited.
But I could see the door. So I knew when she drove in. And I wanted to meet her at the door, and I did.
They had a nice time, catching up with each other and old friends. When it was over, Doris drove herself home.
I thought it was a great evening. That was all. I didn't expect we'd be seeing each other again.
But the next day, Norm knocked on Doris's door again. And this time, something started to take hold. After Norm returned to North Carolina, he called and wrote Doris letters almost every day.
There was just a feeling that is just like it's brand new. Just like it's brand new. It was super.
Doris felt it too. It was different than anything she had felt before.
Yeah, it was. Oh, this is what I was supposed to feel like.
About 6 months later, Norm moved back to Maine and straight into Doris's house. 4 years later, at the age of 71, they got married. It was the second time for each, but the first time for love.
I don't know that love changes. I think your looks at it, your realistic view of it changes, because you can tell this from that. You can feel the difference, and inside you know it. No question. You know it.
Looking back, Norm and Doris say they knew it years ago at the water fountain. But sometimes, says Doris, there are reasons to wait.
There's a purpose in life, and sometimes you can't control your own purpose or why you're here. And I figure, all right, so I was supposed to have had these lessons given to me earlier. And as I go through, I've learned the lessons, I hope.
This May, Doris and Norm Blomquist will celebrate their 13th anniversary. Life, says Norm, is entirely different now that he's married to Doris.
It's bright and shiny. It was awful dull before.
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Maine Public Radio's series In This Life is made possible by a grant from the Dorie Taylor Charitable Foundation. And for more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Monday, March 27th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.